Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Jeffrey J. Holsing. For the appellant, State of South Dakota, is Mr. William Janklow, an attorney from Brandon, and Deputy State's Attorney of Brookings County, Mark Crotteville from Brookings. Mr. Janklow, I understand you'll be doing the presentation this morning. Okay. And for the defendant, appellee, is Ms. Melissa Neville, an attorney from Aberdeen. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself in this matter, and the court has appointed the Honorable Randall Macy, a circuit judge from the 4th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Zinner's place. Mr. Janklow, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes, sir.
Chief Justice and members of the court, I'm going to be extremely brief in talking about the facts of this case because they're really well recited in the written materials. This is a case that arose when a gentleman named Mr. Holsing was a taekwondo instructor, and he taught basically younger people, young individuals. There came a point in time when he decided to become, for whatever reason, a predator on young females. He touched them inappropriately. He put his fingers in inappropriate places. There was oral sex performed upon him by these young females. There was sexual intercourse performed by young females. There was a whole plethora of sexual activity that he had these young females engage in. He was charged with a couple of counts in Brookings County. After some preliminary matters, he pled guilty to the charges. He pled guilty to charges. As part of the sentence, Judge Steele, at the point of time that he sentenced him, said that you will pay for the court costs of counseling for the victims. And at least one of these victims has had to have counseling, the fact that you utterly disregarded. Now, there was a long sentence comment by Judge Steele, wherein he talked about a lot of different facts, none of which were objected to by any party. But the key thing is this was the oral sentence that Judge Steele entered. And then Judge Steele, in a written order, added something, and this is what causes some of the problems in the case. He, in number 5, on page 40 of the settled record, that the sentence shall make full restitution, in full to the victims for the cost of any counseling that said victims may have incurred as a result of the offenses. It is further ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the cost and restitutions heretofore ordered paid shall be paid according to a schedule to be determined by the Board of Pardons and Parole, should said defendant make parole. Members of the court, we submit that the Board of Pardons and Paroles, consistent with the Gullickson case and other cases, does not have the authority or the power to set any monetary amount. At the time that Mr. Holsing was sentenced, there was no definite amount of dollars that had yet been decided as to what he would be responsible for. And the reason for that is that the counseling and the assistance was ongoing.
Is the counseling still ongoing today?
It is not ongoing today, Your Honor, but it was ongoing as of 2 months ago.
Okay, so we have a dollar certain that Brookings County or the state thinks should be reimbursed.
That is correct. And now, at the time that the order to show cause was entered, Justice Gilbertson, Mr. Crotteville, when he brought the action in court, the judge set up a time for hearing, actually set up discovery so that consistent with the rights of Mr. Holsing, they would be able to figure out what are the appropriate amounts, are there any items that are questionable, is it all attributable to the actions that he took with the young lady in the past. And we never got to that stage because the judge made a determination that he'd lost jurisdiction pursuant to statutes.
Has the statute of limitations run as far as a civil remedy is concerned?
Pardon me, sir?
Has a statute of limitations run as far as a civil remedy is
concerned? Yes, sir. The statute of limitations has run if she were going to file a civil action. And And so I don't know why a civil action wasn't brought. I can only make an assumption, and that is that it was being handled within the purview of the criminal law. There is a statute, Your Honor, that says that an order of restitution can be enforced as other civil matters, but it doesn't talk about how you figure out what the amount is. The only way to figure out the amount in this case was to wait for time, because this young lady was under an ongoing situation. And that's exactly the reason that the judge made that statement that he made. He referenced one individual that was undergoing counseling, but he made it plural with respect to ordering restitution for the victims for whatever assistance they may need. So that's the situation where we're in. This, unfortunately, the statute's changed during this point in time.
Mr. Jenkla, let me ask you about that, because at the time Mr. Holsing was sentenced, didn't the statute allow the Board of Pardons and Paroles to set restitution?
No, sir, it didn't. At the time that the Board, I don't believe it ordered them to set it. What it did was it ordered the Department of the Board of Pardons and Paroles, it gave them the authority to, I can just grab the statute here, sir. It was 2328.3. And this is the predecessor statute to the existing one. First of all, it said the judge may, if he gives a suspended imposition of sentence, probation, and that didn't apply here. But then in the final sentence said, if the sentencing court orders the defendant to the state penitentiary and does not suspend the sentence, the Board of Pardons and Paroles shall require as a condition of parole that the defendant, in cooperation with the executive director of the Board of Pardons and Paroles, prepare a plan of restitution as described in this section.
And now, doesn't that section indicate that the name and the name of the victim and the amount is to be set?
If this statute is going, but this is a parole statute, Your Honor, we submit that this statute deals with what happens if the individual is going to be paroled. If he was never going to be paroled, if he served every day of his time and flattened, and didn't have any, and because of whatever reasons he served every day of his time, then they would have to argue that restitution doesn't even apply in this case. Because this is a statute that specifically says that it comes into play if the individual is going to be paroled. We submit that that is not what Judge Steele ordered. What Judge Steele added in his written order was that the Board of Pardons and Paroles would deal with the schedule aspect. But this statute, Your Honor, let me back up. What this predecessor statute required is the names of the victims, the amounts, and all of that kind of stuff was to be set by court services. If court services wasn't involved because they were in the penitentiary, then the Board of Pardons and Paroles was to do that. But that's only as a condition of parole. And we submit that over and above this statute that gave the Board of Pardons and Paroles this, if there was going to be parole, there is an order that is in place that can be enforced without resorting to the Board of Pardons and Paroles. That's the essence of what our case is.
And that would pick up the people who are flat timers then, because they're never going to see the Board of Pardons and Paroles.
That's correct. They would pick up the people, and let's just assume that he said that, I'm just talking, let's assume that he said, I won't do this. Well, then he wouldn't have probably been paroled. But if he wasn't paroled, that would have been a way to escape then the responsibility of making restitution. That would also be a way to cut off restitution. And court orders last for 20 years, and there isn't any question. This is not unlike the Gullickson case. In the Gullickson case, they said the Board of Pardons and Paroles doesn't have the power to set dollar amounts. Thayer confirmed that. In the Thayer case, this court cited the Gullickson case for the proposition that the Board of Pardons and Paroles can't set an amount. And to do it this system way, it would be the Board of Pardons and Paroles that would be making the decisions and setting the amount, and not the circuit court.
Well, when he was paroled, the dollar amount wouldn't have even been known, would it, because it was still ongoing on the treatment?
Your Honor, that is exactly the situation that we're in. And that is the reason that Mr. Prattville, prior to the time that the suspended portion of Mr. Holsing's sentence, because he was sentenced to 7.5 years, of which 4 years on each count was made concurrently, and the remaining 3.5 years was a suspended sentence. And it was during the suspended sentence portion of his punishment that the state brought the action to have this, to have it determined as to what the amount is in order to show cause as to why he shouldn't be required to be jailed or for some other remedy in order to get him on a payment schedule. That's exactly the process that was followed, sir. In addition to that, if I could, I don't think that there's any way, let me back up. We do have a statute that also required that when it comes to minors that are being violated, that the judge was required to order that there be payments made for their psychiatric, for their psychological, and for their medical treatment. This is exactly what Judge Steele did. Judge Steele said, you're going to pay this. And the victims shouldn't be held responsible for this. The victim should not be held responsible for what took place with respect to this case. And Judge Steele, in his later decision, decided that 2328.3 did not, as you'd indicated, Judge, did not apply, or should I should say did apply, as to how the amount was set. But we submit on the basis of the Gullickson case and the Thayer case that the Board of Pardons and Paroles could not set a dollar amount, and this was something that had to be determined only by a judge. And we have procedures where a person won't be jailed, where a person can be given relief, where a person can be given extended periods of time, where there can be modifications made on the application of the defendant in this case. The defendant is the one that should be the appellant in this case. He could have appealed his case. We forget that Mr. Holson knew he was going to have to pay restitution. It was, in effect, part of his plea bargain, because he made a plea bargain when he pled guilty, and although it wasn't put out specifically in writing, our law required that the judge shall include, as portion of the sentence in this particular type of case, the cost of medical, psychological, and psychiatric assistance to the victims. That's exactly what Judge Steele did. And if Mr. Holsing didn't like that language of the sentence, Mr. Holsing is the one that should have appealed the sentence. But he shouldn't be allowed to come in later, years later, and complain that now he's responsible for what the law said he was responsible for at the time that he did it.
Now, he did pay, he was ordered, or he was required by the Board of Pardons and Paroles to pay some amount, was he not?
Yes, ma'am. He was ordered to pay $5,000 and some dollars.
How'd that figure come about?
That was an amount that had been, that the Board of Pardons and Paroles had of treatment up to a certain point in time. It isn't in the record, Judge, but the victim went and complained to the chairman of the Board of Pardons and Paroles, and he said, I'll see what I can do. And then they got a call from a parole agent in Aberdeen who said, I'll see what I can do. And as a result, $5,000 was paid. There was no formalization of anything in this case. And it's referred to in the record, but there you'll find nothing in the record where there was any formalization of notice or setting by the Board of Pardons and Paroles of any real dollar amount. They didn't have the power to set the dollar amount.
Well, prior to the change in the statute in 1999, didn't the Board of Pardons and Paroles routinely set amounts of restitution?
Well, they may have, but they didn't have the legal authority to do it. I mean, they very well may have done it, but the statute required that the judge, that, as a matter of fact, the courts had cases. I believe one of them was the this is getting old. The Tuttle case required that you have to have a hearing before you can actually have these amounts set. And the Board of Pardons and Paroles did a set it, and in a lot of instances there wasn't. My guess is that's what it is that in most of these instances it wasn't. It was a set amount. Something was stolen, something was destroyed. It was something that you could do with definiteness, and so there was no argument. But in reality, this was a case where the treatment was ongoing, and the judge knew it, and Mr. Holsing knew it, and so it took later action. And as this court has said, the Board of Pardons and Paroles can't set the amount. They don't have the power, the legal power to set the amount. They have the power to set a schedule.
I thought the board set a restitution hearing for December 13th, 2002. The victims were given notice of the hearing, and then the amount of restitution was set at $5,700. Isn't that right?
It apparently is. I don't know. Yes. The record says that. The record says that. Now, it doesn't say that with respect. Let me say this. Judge Steele found in a sentence in his decision that there had been notice. I don't know that there's any. I've seen no other notice other than that. I've seen nothing else in the record. I can find nothing else in the record where they talk about, where the appellant's brief talks about, excuse me, the appellee's brief talks about stuff like that in the record, Your Honor. There's, when you look at that portion of the settled record, what you're going to see is Judge Steele's decision where there's a sentence on it without any dates and times like that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackal. Okay, Ms. Neville, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Melissa Neville, and I represent the appellee, Jeff Holsing, in this case. And first, I'd like to begin by saying that this case is not about enforcing a court's order for restitution. This case is about modifying the restitution that has already been set after a hearing was duly held. Now, Justice Gilbertson, you indicated when you questioned Mr. Janklow, well, how could they set this when the amount was unknown, that it was still ongoing at the time of parole? They had had, she had began, according to the bills that were submitted to the court in the order to show cause, a year and 2 months prior to the restitution hearing that was held by the board, in which she had been going on through counseling. So, as in any other case where restitution has to be set for future damages, and this court has specifically said we look at the civil measure of damages, it could have been easily done to bring in the counselor who was treating her for counseling and say, here's the plan of counseling, here's what she's doing, here's what it's costing, and here's how long I anticipate this to last.
So you keep him on parole the whole time she's on counseling to make sure he pays the bill?
That's certainly up to the court at that time. The court presumably approved the Board of Pardons and Paroles restitution amount that was set.
Is there an order in the record where the court approves that amount?
We don't have an order. We only have Judge Steele's memorandum opinion saying the board followed the rules, provided notice, set the amount, and the amount was approved. And if the judge said that in his memorandum opinion, then I didn't question that. And honestly, the state didn't question it either.
Is the problem here that it's an open-ended order on the original sentence as opposed to the Gullickson order, which had a specific amount?
It is. Frankly, that is the problem.
But why is that? Then, I mean, aren't we treating victims differently?
The problem is, Your Honor, I agree that the court did not set a fixed amount. And back in the pre-1999 days before the statute was amended to say you have to fix the amount and you have to identify the victim to which it applies, that was a hazard. That was what happened. And Justice Macy is correct that it was routinely done where the Board of Pardons and Paroles did set the amount. A hearing was held. It had been approximately 4 years after sentencing was done. Presumably, that would have been enough time to have known that the counseling was ongoing and how much it would cost. And in fact, the state admits in its response to our motion to dismiss that future expenses or post-sentencing expenses were presented and included by Cynthia Arndt in that hearing, which then resulted in the $5,700 and some dollars that were set for restitution. Our position, Your Honor, is that that hearing was held. The state had its day to present that evidence. And where is the finality in this case, which is a fundamental tenet when it comes to criminal sentencing, to allow someone to be on the hook indefinitely or even up to 20 years when the statute limits the person's exposure to the maximum sentence that he would receive?
Is there a difference because this is a child?
No, there's not, Your Honor. There is a specific statute that says in cases where a victim has been abused, the court shall award some or all of the counseling or medical expenses. Interestingly, in this case, the court did order costs for counseling, but not medical expenses. And a cursory examination of the bills that were listed indicate that, you know, obviously we will be challenging, if this court were to find against us, that not all of those bills were for counseling. But that doesn't provide a separate remedy for the victim to come back at any time and, challenge what had already been set in a hearing that was given notice for both. And, in fact, there is a statute that states that if the victim disagrees with what's been set by the Board of Pardons and Paroles and then approved by the court, the victim's only remedy is a civil remedy.
Well, now, when you say approved by the court, there's no order where the circuit court approved it.
We do not have an order, but presumably when the court stated that all of the rules were followed by the Board of Pardons and Paroles, that under SDCL...
Well, isn't the argument that the circuit court judge lost jurisdiction when the defendant was sentenced to the state penitentiary? And didn't Judge Steele order counseling and also ordered that the restitution be set by the Board of Pardons and Parole?
He did, Your Honor. And that is true that pursuant to the pre-99 statute, 28-22-3, that the board did have the authority to do that. And he ordered the board to set the amount. Now, if the state's here contending the board didn't have the authority to set the amount, then what happened was a sentence that was imposed in an illegal manner. And Rule 35 allows the court to go back and correct a sentence imposed in an illegal manner, but only 1 year, at that time it was 1 year, now it's 2 years, only 1 year after the sentence is imposed. So ultimately the state is too late to ask the court to now go back and fix something that it did, and as Justice Meyer-Henry pointed out, an open-ended order that was not necessarily legal or implied in a, or applied in a legal way, is too late to correct that.
Okay, in a perfect world, what should the state have done to get full restitution?
In a perfect world, the state should have presented the evidence at the 2002 hearing in December before the Board of Pardons and Paroles, and the state had at least a year and 2 months of notice of the ongoing counseling that she was going through for her anorexia, and could have at least at that point stated, brought in the psychologist that was presumably treating her, presented the evidence and said, here's what we anticipate or reasonably anticipate to be the future expenses for this woman and her treatment.
What if your client had flat-timed it?
And I presume the justice is referring to, you know, where do they get lost in the system if that parole statute is not applied?
I mean, parole, you have to apply for it. All right, your client's saying, this is getting kind of spendy. I think I'll just sit here for a few more months, flat-time it and leave, and then what if?
Then we're right back to that illegal sentence or the sentence imposed in a legal manner. And unfortunately, the state cannot use Rule 35 to go back and fix or increase a sentence or punishment.
And the other problem with the Board of Pardons and Paroles setting it is that it can't be, only an order of the court can turn into a civil judgment. Anything the Board of Pardons and Paroles sets can only be enforced by the Board of Pardons and Paroles. Do you think that's what the legislature meant by this scheme of laws?
I agree that that is a problem, and that's presumably why there's the statute that says then the court has to approve what the plan that's been set by the Board of Pardons and Paroles. And I think also that's why the legislature recognized after this court's series of cases on restitution and Justice Saber's opinion indicating that restitution is a problem and the scheme is not very clear. So in 1999 and 2004, they sort of revamped those restitution statutes, and this scenario has probably been taken care of by the new statute that says you have to identify an amount and a victim. That doesn't fix the problem that we have with that case in an open-ended order. The fact is, the order probably was imposed in an illegal manner, but Rule 35 does not allow us to go back more than a year after and correct that. There has to be some finality. Where does it end? And it's interesting that the state wants to say, well, we're not increasing his punishment. But if he were to sit in jail at $40 a day, which, again, is not the right statute, would have been $20 a day pursuant to the time that he was sentenced, at $40 a day for $190,000 and some change, he would sit 13 years and 25 days.
Which maybe he should sit if he had the ability to pay and chose not to.
If he has the ability to pay and chooses not to, that would be the scenario.
Well, if he can't pay, then he doesn't sit, right?
Certainly we would challenge that, but that is a hearing for another day. We would challenge whether these are causally related. There's been no identification that they have been. There was ongoing discovery regarding that. And there was another issue that was raised. It's interesting that the state indicates that the defendant could have appealed and didn't. Well, he had no reason to appeal. The amount was set. He paid it. He complied with all of the terms set by the court. And at the time that he was discharged from parole, the remainder of his sentence was suspended. And then we had over a year between that time that his sentence was suspended to the time that the state brings its motion for order to show cause. How do we even apply the criminal statutes to him once his sentence has been duly satisfied?
Did he pay that $5,000 prior to getting the notice in front of Judge Steele on the hearing?
Yes, he did. Yes, and in fact, it was about a year, and I want to say a year and 2 months. He was discharged from parole, paid in full on July 1st of 04, and the application for order to show cause was filed July 8th of 05.
Thank you.
The Gullickson case has been raised repeatedly for authority to say the Board of Pardons and Paroles can't do this, can't set the amount. But again, I'd like to make clear to the court that the Gullickson case was a 2003 case interpreting post-1999 statute, the 2883. So,
but Gullickson was arrested long and convicted long before 1999.
I don't recall, Your Honor, when he was arrested and convicted.
I would guess the 1980s.
The fact is that Gullickson was interpreting the statutes as it was in 2003, and those are not the statutes as they apply to Holsing in 1998 when he was sentenced.
The change in 99 indicated that the Board of Pardons and Paroles could no longer set restitution. It had to be the circuit court judge. Is that correct?
That's correct.
A couple of times you've referred to the circuit court approving the order of restitution by the Board of Pardons and Paroles. You said a statute. Is there a statute that says that?
Yes, and I was trying to find that quickly, Your Honor. A28(4). It says the court shall promptly enter an order approving the plan or modifying it and providing for restitution payments to the extent that the defendant is or may be reasonably able to make restitution. And that was in effect at the time of defendant's Holsing sentencing. That statute has also been raised to support the fact that the restitution can be modified at any time. But I would like to point out to the court that statute provides that it may be modified at the motion of the defendant or the court, not at the motion of the state or a subsequent application by the victim for additional bills.
Well, why would the court do it unless the victim had raised that issue?
The scenario that I could envision, Your Honor, is if the defendant is finding difficulty paying. He can't maintain the schedule and would need to modify it.
You know, you argue finality. There does need to be finality. What is the basis of your argument on that? Is there case law? Is it a due process issue? What is that that would create a necessity for a finality on a restitution order?
Well, essentially, SCCL 23A27 4.1 prohibits the de facto modification more than a year afterwards. But whether you call it ex post facto, increasing the punishment after it's been served, whether you call it due process, coming back over a year after the sentence has been completed and attempting to punish him again, or whether you call it res judicata because enforcing a judgment is in the nature of a civil process, whatever you call it, it's too late for the state to come back now and submit $190,000+ in restitution and say, oh, by the way, you still owe this, and we can enforce this judgment for 20 years. There has to be some finality, and we agree with the state that open-ended order was illegally applied. And we also agree that to be meaningful, a restitution hearing probably should have been done within the time to correct the sentence, within the 1 year at that time. To have the hearing 4 years later is just as problematic and probably could have been appealed by Holsing at that time, but he didn't. He agreed to pay the $5,700 that was set in restitution. He complied with what the court set for him, and he's followed all of the rules, and the parole was discharged. The state contends at page 5 of its reply that it has 20 years to come back, presumably again and again. And what's asked of this court today, I believe, is to determine how many sentencing or how many restitution hearings the state is entitled to, not the defendant, how many times the state can come back and change, and to determine whether what was done in December of 2002 with the Board of Pardons and Paroles constituted a duly processed or duly held restitution hearing. If it did, The state had its chance, and it should not be entitled to a second bite at the apple to bring back additional charges.
Is there a difference? You keep saying the state, but they're not suing or trying to get room and board reimbursement or investigative costs that the state had to eat. I mean, these are a third-party victim. Is there a difference there?
Your Honor, I realize that the court has a duty to try to protect victims, and if this court wants to swing that door open to protect victims in a certain manner, then we just caution that it's very careful on how far we swing that door. Where's the end? Where do we decide how late is too late, how many hearings is too many, and what constitutes a restitution hearing? The criminal statutes aren't there to enforce or uphold civil remedies. And if the victim in this case was not happy with what was set by the Board of Pardons and Paroles, her exclusive remedy as provided in the statute is to bring a civil action. We realized that statute of limitations had run even before Mr. Holsing was indicted. She was 22 at the time the charges were filed, so presumably it would have been too late even when they were filed. But as Judge Steele recognized, it's not the job of that court in a criminal setting to safeguard those civil remedies. The state also contends that Holsing was within the suspended portion of his sentence. I would like to correct that. He was not within the suspended portion of his sentence when he was discharged from parole and had complied with all of the court's conditions and terms that were set. His sentence was actually suspended pursuant to what the court ordered. Once it was suspended, then these criminal statutes no longer apply to him. Ultimately, Your Honor, we're asking that this court affirm the circuit court's decision and dismiss the state's order to show cause. And unless the court has any further questions,
I have. In Gullickson, there's some language about the order of restitution being a separate order that the court imposes, which is the basis for the continuing jurisdiction. Why doesn't that apply here as a separate order?
I'm not really sure why the court stated that, except that I think it was stating that it was not linked to any suspended sentence. In that case, it was a separate order because of embezzlement, and the victim or the defendant in that case agreed to pay back the amount that he had embezzled. It was part of his plea agreement, and it was in the sentence. But SDCL 23A27 25.2 specifically states, in any case in which they are imposed, costs and restitution are part of the punishment. If it's part of the punishment, it's part of the sentence. And to increase that punishment after the fact, or more than a year after the fact, is an ex post facto increase in the punishment. And according to Rule 35, it cannot be done. This court's hearing case law has repeatedly stated Rule 35 cannot be used to increase the sentence after the fact. Any other questions? Thank you.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early. Thank you, Ms. Newell. Mr. Janklow, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have a question before you start. What is this going to open the floodgates forever? What about the finality, the necessity of finality and the ex post facto?
One, I don't believe there's any ex post facto because this was in the judge's sentencing order at the time that he had the sentencing procedure. The judge has added nothing. Nobody's added anything to this man's sentence. What they didn't know when he was sentenced, Judge, was what's the total amount going to be? And the judge knew that, and that's why he said, at least one of the victims is at counseling, but you're going to pay for the cost of these victims. The second part of your question?
Well, I mean, I don't know how many orders there are or sentences out there like that are open-ended. Is this going to open some floodgate for somebody that's been convicted, released, their rights have been restored for 20, 30 years, and all of a sudden we've got a victim coming back and saying, I want restitution?
Well, you know, I can just answer on this specific case, okay? On this particular case, the state started an action. Judge Steele then ordered the process to start. The Holsing asked for discovery. The judge granted it, and the process was going when Judge Steele decided, hey, I've deprived of jurisdiction. I can't hear this matter. But the finality would be that there would be this hearing. And by the way, our statutes, Judge, provide that at any time in the future people can go before the court and have the restitution situations modified, changed, enforced, and things of that nature. So our statutes, you know, anticipate that particular type of thing. Counsel, when she was answering questions, first of all was asked about the process that was followed, and I just explained it. This was an order to show cause, basically why she shouldn't be held in contempt. And yes, they talked about $40 a day, but the fact of the matter is, Judge Steele had the inherent authority and was following it to follow the process. And our statutes make it very clear, and our cases make it even clearer, if people cannot afford to pay the restitution, the court's duty-bound to make modifications, adjustments, and have understanding. Here we haven't gotten to that point. We don't know what the resources of this individual are. We don't know if this individual can or can't pay what it is that he owes. Second of all, counsel stated that the medical issues, that the statute did not provide for the payment of medical issues. Well, I draw the court's attention to 23A28(6). I'm sorry, it's not the right statute. Where it talks about, let me grab the right one. I'm sorry. 23A28(12), minor victims. When anyone is convicted under 2610(1), 2222(7), which is us, 2222(19.9), or subdivision 2222(1), shall be required as part of the sentence imposed by the court to pay the cost of any necessary medical, psychological, or psychiatric treatment, foster care for the minor resulting from the acts or for which he was convicted, or the person is convicted. That's one. Two, we talked about the Judge Steele approved it in his order. Members of the court, you look at Judge Steele's order. It's a short 3-page order. There isn't a word in here that Judge Steele ever approved what was done by the Board of Pardons and Paroles. What Judge Steele does say in his decision is that the Board of Pardons and Paroles did something, but he makes no findings. The only sentence he ever alludes to it in his order is in his order, Judge Steele says in the middle of a paragraph on the last page, he says, under the statutory scheme as it existed at the time of sentence, the court reluctantly concludes that because the court suspended only part of the sentence and was sent to the penitentiary, the court was deprived of jurisdiction. So that's what Judge Steele was saying. Therefore, the plan of restitution was the responsibility of the Board of Pardons and Paroles. We submit that's not correct. It appears that the victims were given due notice of the restitution hearing and offered an opportunity to contest any plan. Under the statutory scheme that existing at the time, if the victim is not satisfied with the restitution award, the assistive remedy is a civil action. That's what he said. He didn't say that he approved anything. In addition to that, counsel was asked about the Gullickson case. The Gullickson case very, very clearly says in the decision, I draw the court's attention to P16. Second, the circuit court ordered restitution separate and independent of Gullickson's prison sentence. SDCL 226-1 provides in pertinent part. The court, in imposing sentence on a defendant who has been found guilty of a felony, shall in order, in addition to the sentence that it imposed, pursuant to provisions of this section, that the defendant make restitution to any victim in accordance with the provisions of Chapter 23A-28, emphasis.
Mr. Janklow, don't our statutes, though, require that a specific amount be set? The 1998 statute says specific amount. The 1999 statute says specific amount.
It does if you're going to use the Board of Pardons and Paroles plan. But the court should have set the amount. And that's the very point. That statute did say, the predecessor statute, and the existing one, says that the court has to set an amount, name the victims, lay out the names of the victims, and lay out what the amount is. Here they couldn't because it was prospective. The court would have had to cut it off as of the date of sentence. And so what the court said is you will do that. And if Mr. Holzing didn't like it, I again say, Mr. Holzing could have appealed that sentence. Mr. Holzing and his two counsel both knew that, one, what the statutes required at the time that he pled guilty, and two, they knew what Judge Steele said. And had he felt aggrieved by this prospective order, he should have appealed it. But he can't come and complain later about the enforcement of an order the court gave while he stood there mute with his lawyers and did nothing. So that's, we think this matter ought to be sent back to the circuit court, that they ought to have the hearings that are necessary. Mr. Holsing can come in and object and complain about anything, that only with suitable evidence will be acceptable, and a decision will be made as to what Mr. Holsing can pay to remedy the wrong. Why should this victim have to be responsible for these horrendous bills as a result of the activity and the liberties that he took with this young lady? So we submit it should be sent, it should be reversed and remanded, sent back to the circuit court, so the circuit court can make a decision as to what the appropriate amount is if Mr. Holsing objects to what the total amount is that we have.
I'm concerned with whether or not it is actually an open-ended judgment, because from the statement that you read earlier, you said one of the conditions was that Holsing was to, quote, make restitution in full to the victims for the costs of any counseling that said victims may have incurred as a result of said offenses. Isn't that the opposite of an open-ended judgment? Isn't that res judicata then, if that's not appealed? Because that refers to expenses that have been incurred.
Judge, the oral sentence report was, you will pay for the cost of counseling of the victims, and at least one of these victims has had to have counseling, the fact that you utterly disregarded. That's what was said at the time of sentencing. And in the written order that was entered in the sentence of the court, the court said, the defendant shall make restitution in full to the victims for the cost of any counseling the victims may have incurred as a result of the offenses. But we submit that written order couldn't modify the oral sentence, and the oral sentence made it very clear that it could be prospective and may have incurred. Unfortunately, you can read it more than one way, and I realize that. May have incurred means may have incurred as of right now, may have incurred as to some point in time, at the time when it becomes, when you get to the end of the treatment cycle.
But isn't it the state's obligation to take issue with the written order? Don't they have to appeal it if they object to it?
I would say yes to that, just as Mr. Holsing, if they objected to the order, should have objected to it.
They obviously had no objection to that order.
Pardon?
They obviously had no objection to that order.
But if you go to the next sentence, well, it depends on how you read those words. I mean, and I do think you can read them more than one way. I mean, it's troubling the way I read them. I'm not going to kid you and say it isn't. But I mean, I think depending on how you read it, you can read it as a, it's cut off right now, or they may have incurred, meaning the totality of the treatment cycle. And you can, I really believe you can read it both ways. I think that's why the oral sentence makes it very clear, and I don't think they really modified it in the written sentence. And then what he says is the question, hereby ordered, are paid by a schedule determined by the Board of Pardons and Paroles. What the judge said is the Board of Pardons and Paroles has set up a schedule should he make parole.
Thank you, your time.
Thank you,
Your
Honor, very much.
Court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.
10 o'clock.